Good morning, everyone. I'm Cass and I'm tag teaming with Chloe for today's message. We've pre-recorded today to save us from any Zoom mishaps. And we're continuing with the series of messages on the theme of leaving the 99, which we've been looking at over the last few weeks. The video that we've just watched is the story of a double healing in Mark 5. And it picks up really nicely where Sally and Ash have left off in previous weeks. It tells another story of marginalised people that Jesus encounters in the Gospels. The passage is a really action-packed one. Two stories are interwoven here. Jesus heals a woman who's bled for 12 years and raises a girl, aged 12, from the dead. The setting is noisy, crowded and chaotic, and the situations brought to Jesus are messy and emotional to match. The passage is packed with symbolism too. Mark deliberately tells of this double healing in such a way to reveal to us things about class status, honour culture and purity law. In his political reading of Mark's Gospel, theologian Ched Myers states that his story is a dramatisation of Jesus' preferential treatment of the poor. And I would add that it shows Jesus' preferential love for marginalised women too. Being as so much is going on here, I can see why this passage is a favourite of Ash's. It certainly captured Chloe and I's interest too, being as it contains three things which we really like: Jesus, women, and the challenging of social norms. Over to Chloe.
In order to really appreciate how culturally shocking and revolutionary Jesus' actions would have been here, we need to discuss the social dynamics of the time. A person's position in society was determined very differently in first century Palestine, governed by what is called honour culture. Bruce Molina describes honour as symbolising a person's rightful place in society, his social standing. A person's status within the honour system determined who they could speak to, how they should interact with their superiors and subordinates, and what role they fulfilled in society. Under this system, women were not able to be assertive or dominant. In fact, a man's ability to exert control over his female partner was seen as an important component of his respectability. This is what made Jesus' actions so outrageous. A destitute and unclean woman from the very bottom of the honour scale interrupts him as he is en route to visit the daughter of Jairus, a powerful man at the very top of the honour scale. And Jesus' response to this woman is the absolute opposite of what Mark's original audience would have expected. He turns the rules and traditions of society on their head. He stands in solidarity with the poor and the outcast, and he rejects injustice and oppression.
Along with navigating honour culture, we also have to take into account Jewish purity laws in order to understand the impact the story would have had at the time. The purity laws in relation to menstruation are found in Leviticus chapter 15. Here the regulations surrounding periods are outlined, along with the prescribed sacrifices that must be made by a woman to atone for a time of ceremonial uncleanliness. Because of her illness, the woman who had bled for 12 years would have been regarded as perpetually unclean. She would not be allowed into the temple, making her cut off from worship. She would have been cut off from society. She would have been unable to marry, with all the social and financial burdens that that would have carried. Worse still, she wouldn't have been allowed to touch or be touched by anyone else, because she would have contaminated others. Even any object she touched would be rendered unclean for the rest of the day. Just imagine the weight of this law upon the woman's life. Navigating these regulations would have been difficult enough during a regular period, but imagine 12 years of being infectious. A terrible stigma would have surrounded the woman. People may have avoided her when they saw her in the street for fear of being contaminated too. Strictly speaking, she shouldn't have even been in the crowd, because of the risk. And yet, in verse 27, she creeps up behind Jesus, touches his cloak, and is healed. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. And when Jesus looks around to find her, she might have been expecting a big telling off for breaking the rules, for contaminating Jesus. But instead, she is treated with tenderness. But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." Later in the story, Jesus encounters Jairus' daughter, who during the commotion with the woman in the crowd has died. Hearing the stories of Jairus' daughter and the woman together leads us to compare the two characters, and with the exception of their gender and the number 12 being significant in both their stories, they couldn't be more different. Jairus' daughter is ruling class. Thanks to the patriarchy, her father is the only person other than Jesus to be named in the story. Jairus is a synagogue leader. In contrast, the woman is poor. We know she's unmarried with the financial burdens that brings, and we're told that she spent any money she did have on doctors. The woman is impure. The girl, while she's alive anyway, is pure and innocent. The girl has a whole life ahead of her. At 12, she would have been on the cusp of getting married, and it would have been considered a terrible tragedy for her to die just short of attaining that life stage. In contrast, the woman is exploited, segregated, past it, not really worth the bother. In short, the woman is out, and the girl is most definitely in. The logical choice here is for Jesus to save Jairus' daughter. Time is of the essence, there's not a moment to lose, and it makes perfect sense to go running to the girl to spare her life. But of course, Jesus doesn't take the logical choice. He makes the woman his first priority. What an example of leaving the 99, leaving the inside of people to save the one out. By the end of the story, both the woman and the girl are restored to physical and social wholeness. The extremes of the social scale have been levelled. Both are called daughter. In verse 34, Jesus says to the woman, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." And when he raises the girl from the dead, he says in Aramaic, which I won't attempt, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Jesus brings hope. Jesus brings hope in hopeless situations. His radical love and acceptance of the marginalised means that the woman is in because he was willing to go out, as Ash talked about last week. In fact, what strikes me most about this story is that Jesus goes out, as in out of his way to restore the woman with bleeding to community. Although the woman would have been secretly healed regardless, without Jesus deliberately seeking her out, this story would have never been told, and we wouldn't have been speaking about it over Zoom 2,000 years later. The bleeding woman's experience was shrouded in shame, and although I like to think that privately at least, her fellow sisters would have felt empathy for her, the elephant in the room would have never been publicly discussed. It leads me to think about what subjects surrounding women and minority genders we just don't like to speak about. What rules and social norms, written and unspoken, apply to the way people are treated in church today? And what biases, conscious and unconscious, affect the way we treat one person over another? Preferences that, rightly so, would never be articulated, but can be unconsciously and hurtfully implied. On the 8th of March, it's International Women's Day. Wouldn't it be great if we could spend some time around that date thinking about these questions, starting to unpack some intersectional feminist topics around the experience of women, gender identity, class, race, disability, and so much more. Many of the social norms, biases and preferences that abound around womanhood are at large in our society, and so it's only natural that they filter through to church, right? When we come back to this story that we've heard in Mark 5, I don't think we can accept that view. In his treatment of outsiders, not just in this passage, but countless others in the Gospels, Jesus demonstrates not only equality, but preferential treatment for marginalised people. Playing catch up with the rest of society isn't enough. We need to lead the way when it comes to equality. All those years ago, the story of healing and restoration of the bleeding woman was regarded as divisive. Talking about these topics in church may be difficult, but getting the stories of marginalised people out into the open is a must. Over to Chloe.
So, who is the bleeding woman in today's society, in our church? Though the honour culture underpinning this passage may not be so prevalent in this country today, it would be naive of us to think that the patriarchy this woman suffered under isn't still a problem, especially in the church. What we know is that certain genders are particularly marginalised today, namely transgender and non-binary people. And these people have been victimised by the church for many years. I've attended multiple LGBTQ events where these people have been harassed and bullied in the name of Jesus. The internet is rife with propaganda from Christian groups which suggests that transgender people pose a danger to children, questions their sanity, even debates whether trans and non-binary people really exist. So we have a lot of making up to do. Even if we aren't the people directly saying these things, the church has hurt these people and they no longer feel welcome. I have transgender friends that think the church hates them. So just permitting them to enter the church would be pointless. Why on earth would they come? We need to give them a reason to come. We need to spend some time and energy showing them that we love them and we actively want them here with us. And this would involve a lot of change on our part. Changing the language we use, diversifying the people we have at the front of church, reviewing our membership policies, maybe our website. It would be transforming our whole position on inclusion. And this may make people profoundly uncomfortable, because change is scary, and we've become accustomed to the way things are here. It works for us, but that's because most of us are the 99. But Jesus' instructions on this are clear. Don't prioritise the comfort and satisfaction of the 99. Leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the lost one until you have found it. It's easy to think that we're already doing enough to welcome the marginalised, because we haven't put restrictions on them coming into our church. But then we put limitations on this welcome. We debate about whether to let them be a member. We question whether they should be allowed to lead worship or teach the young people, because they're different to us and it's complicated and sometimes it's just easier not to rock the boat. But they can absolutely come into the church building and we'll shake their hand at the door and they can sit among us. And we can comfort ourselves with the knowledge that no one can say we're not permitting them to be here. But that is not enough. That isn't inclusion. That is tolerance. That is not the radical welcome and acceptance that Jesus demonstrates through his healing in this passage. Take the bleeding woman. She was already healed just by touching Jesus' cloak. Verse 29 says, immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Jesus could have carried on walking at that point, safe in the knowledge that she's already been healed of her bleeding. But he doesn't. He stops. And he seeks her out and he brings her to him. And despite all of the laws which say that she is unclean and contagious and to be avoided, he touches her. Why? He doesn't need to. We know that Jesus can heal from a distance. We've seen him do it before. Why touch this unclean woman? But Jesus doesn't just let her receive healing and slink off unnoticed. After 12 years of perpetual bleeding, of being an outcast, how likely is it that she will be accepted back into society just on her word that she's been healed? For Jesus, it's not enough that she's no longer bleeding. He wants to fully restore her to community. He gives her space to tell her story. He calls her daughter. He declares her as healed and clean in front of an entire crowd of witnesses. He marks her out as accepted, no longer an outcast. Jesus shows us that inclusion is an active effort. It's not enough for us to just allow marginalised people into the church. What we need to do is go beyond tolerance. Create an environment where the oppressed feel desired, not just put up with. Purposely reach out and invite them in. Transform our physical space and the words we use and our membership rules in a way which lets them know they are not just permitted here, they are wanted here.